We've spent almost 40 weeks now in this middle portion of Luke where Jesus has been moving from one side of Israel, gradually making his way over towards Jerusalem. And today we're going to encounter him at the last little speech he gives before he enters the city of Jerusalem. So just to give you a picture of where we're going, we'll do that today. And then starting next week, we're going to spend a few weeks looking at various psalms. So we're calling that series Songs for Summer. We're just going to spend 7-8 weeks going through some of the staff's favorite psalms. So the next several weeks, you'll hear from various speakers. So Dr. Eugene Clay is going to preach next week, and I know you'll look forward to that. So we'll be doing that next week, and we will jump back into the last part of Luke later in the fall. And the last section of Luke is when Jesus is in Jerusalem. So we'll be covering his entry, his triumphal entry, and then everything from his arrest all the way to the resurrection. So it's going to be a lot of fun. But for today, we have kind of a shocking story to tell. So if you have a Bible, look at Luke 19 with me. If you don't, no problem. It'll be on the screens behind us. But this is one of the more difficult parables that Jesus ever told. And it's kind of confusing and vexing. So it will be fun. Do you ever get confused about what God's up to? Do you ever find yourself questioning, what in the world is God doing? Why would he do something that way? Or why would he not do that way? I think if you've been a believer long enough, and maybe even not, maybe just somebody that believes there is a God, then you've had those days when God has been confusing. Many times that confusion can lead to disappointment and even to despair if it goes far enough. How should we deal with those kinds of feelings? How do we deal with the fact that God is confusing sometimes? Well, today Jesus is going to tell us what we should do with that. And it's enormously helpful and very confusing, all in one. So it will be fun. Luke 19, let's start in verse 12, and I'm going to just read the whole parable, and then we'll spend the rest of the morning kind of walking through it. So verse 12, this is Jesus, said, "A nobleman went into a far country to receive for himself a kingdom and then return. Calling 10 of his servants, he gave them 10 minas and said, 'Engage in business until I come.' But his citizens hated him and sent a delegation after him saying, 'We don't want this man to reign as king over us.' When he returned, having received his kingdom, he ordered these servants to whom he had been given money to be called to him, that he might know what they had gained by doing business. The first came before him saying, 'Lord, your mina has made 10 minas more.' And he said to him, 'Well done, good servant. Because you've been faithful in a very little, you shall have authority over 10 cities.' The second came saying, 'Lord, your mina has made 5 minas.' And he said to him, 'You are over 5 cities.' Then another came saying, 'Lord, here's your mina I kept laid away in a handkerchief. For I was afraid of you, because you're a severe man. You take what you did not deposit. You reap what you did not sow.' He said to him, 'I will condemn you with your own words, you wicked servant. You knew that I was a severe man, taking what I did not deposit, reaping what I didn't sow. Why, then, did you not put money in the bank? And at my coming, I might have collected it with interest.' He said to those who stood by, 'Take the mina from him and give it to the one who has 10 minas.' And they said to him, 'Lord, he has 10 minas. I tell you that to everyone who has, more will be given. But from the one who has not, even what he has will be taken away. But as for these enemies of mine who do not want me to reign over them, bring them here and slaughter them before me.'" Is anyone encouraged? I love Jesus. If Jesus played baseball, he would have been a pitcher because he can throw the most incredible curveballs. What in the world is going on here? What is he talking about? How does this speak to anything helpful in that day or today? And what in the world does this have to do with confusion and disappointment about God? Well, our task for today is to see if we can answer those questions. But before we jump in and really dissect the story, something that might be helpful for you to know is that the kind of situation this story deals with would not have been unfamiliar to the disciples. Any Law and Order fans here? It's okay to be honest. All right. One of the things we like about Law and Order is it has that feel that you've just opened the newspaper and it's ripped from the headlines. And there's times you watch an episode and it seems strikingly similar to something that's just taken place. That's exactly what's going on in this story. Rome was the ruling power in the world, as you know, and kings were put in power all over the place that Rome had conquered, all over the known world. They had to receive their kingdom by going to Rome. So when Herod the Great became king over the Jews, he had to travel to Rome, receive his kingdom, and then come back in order to rule. And in 4 BC, when he died and his son took the throne, he had to do the same thing. He had to travel to Rome in order to receive his kingdom. But there was a problem. The Jews didn't want him. So they sent 50 men from Israel to Rome to basically say to Caesar Augustus, "We don't want this man. Give us somebody else." Does this sound familiar? And Caesar Augustus sort of reached a compromise, and he said, "Well, I won't make him king. I'll call him ethnarch." I don't know if that's a derogatory term or what. It kind of sounds like it. But he said to him, in essence, "You can take the throne, but you're not going to be called king. You're going to be called ethnarch, and you've got to earn the title of king." And so he came back, and he ruled, and he never reached kingship. So the Jews, when they heard this story, would have been thinking of that real-life situation that took place. It would not have seemed strange to them like it does to us. So Jesus is ripping something from the headline in order to present a spiritual truth that at first glance honestly seems not there. It seems hidden. So let's kind of just walk through this step by step and see what it is that he's saying. There's a man that goes to receive his kingdom, like he would have gone to Rome to receive that kingship. And in his absence, he told 10 people to do what? He told them to make some money for him, right? He said to engage in business. So while I'm gone, work hard, make a profit, and when I come back, I'll receive that from you. And he gave each of them something called a mina. A mina was the equivalent of about 3 or 4 months' worth of work. So this was quite a bit of money. And as he's leaving, some of the people say this to him. Verse 14, "But his citizens hated him and sent a delegation after him saying, 'We don't want this man to reign over us.'" That's always what you want to hear when you're becoming king. So the king returns and he asks his servants to give an account. So imagine those 10 servants are here, they're lined up, and they're all going to tell us, here's what we've done as the king has been away. The first servant said he made 10 more. So I'm not very good at math, but I know that's a lot. He made 1,000% profit. So that's pretty good. He did very, very well as a steward. And to read it again, just to make it very clear, the king responds like this, verse 17. He said to him, "Well done, good servant. Because you've been faithful with a little, you shall have authority over 10 cities." So, in essence, the servant is commended. He's given commendation and reward. But the reward is pretty fascinating. The reward he's given is greater responsibility in the kingdom. Now, most of us, when we picture getting a reward, that's not what we picture. We don't picture somebody handing us responsibility. But in the spiritual realm, that is a good thing. And we'll talk about that more in a little bit. But this king, we see, is incredibly generous. Did he have to do that? Was he under any obligation whatsoever to say to his servants, "Great job, now let me give you something in return"? He didn't owe them that. That was not his responsibility. But he did that because he was good and he was gracious. So then the second servant stood in line and he said, "I've made 5 more." And he gets the same response. He, too, is given commendation and reward. So we go on down the line, and we don't go through all 10, but we come to another servant, the third servant. And this guy says, I hid your mina and I didn't do anything with it. You're a severe, unjust, harsh king. So I think the first question we've got to ask is that true? Does the nature of the story present this king as being a hard man, a harsh man? No, it doesn't. It presents him as being gracious and kind. It presents him as being incredibly generous. And on top of that, the servant seems to have not really believed this excuse himself. Because when the Bible uses the word handkerchief here, it's not talking about something you blow your nose in and stick in your pocket, which I think is disgusting, by the way. Why do you want to carry that with you all day? A handkerchief for a Jewish man was something he tied around his neck to keep himself from getting sunburned. And so this man is saying, I stuck this coin somewhere that would have been incredibly easy for me to lose. So he didn't take his role seriously, and he didn't probably think the king was even going to come back. He didn't really believe the king was a harsh, cruel man. Because if he did, what would he have done with the coin? He would have either made more, or he would have had the common sense to put it in the bank, where it was safe and it would draw interest. So he's betraying his own excuse. He's showing he didn't really think this about the king. He didn't care about the king. He was disobedient, unfaithful, and downright foolish. He could have easily lost that money. He didn't represent the king well. He doesn't really even know the king. So the king's response to this guy was appropriate. It was to give him what he was due. It was to take it from him and give it to somebody else. Now, Jesus told this shocking story to tell us to do something. He told it originally to meet the disciples' coming confusion and disappointment with him, with Jesus, and also to help us in our point of confusion and disillusionment with God. He, in essence, told this story to instruct his disciples on how to live until he returns. His point is this, and it's fairly simple. It's when Jesus returns, he will give each person their due based upon their success as stewards. When Jesus returns, he'll give each person their due based upon their success as stewards. So in other words, God entrusts us with things, and he expects us to put them into action. Expects us to follow through. And one day he will ask us to give an account. So how do we put this story to work? Well, I think it's a weird story, a strange story. But if we put it in context, it helps. Last week, we talked about the astonishing fact that Jesus came from heaven, accomplished his earthly mission, which was what? Do you remember? Seek and save the lost. And ascended to heaven, and then delegated that mission to us to complete. So our mission is to make disciples who make disciples. The reason, if you're a follower of Christ, God gives you the ability to draw another breath is so that you would do that. That's why you're here. That's why we're here as a church family. God's given us different gifts, talents, skills, and resources to use to accomplish this task of making disciples. If we were to go around the room, we would find that some of us are better at some things than others, right? Some of us have skills in things that others don't have. And we need to work together in order to accomplish the mission. Some of us are outgoing and people-oriented. Some of us are more reserved and administratively oriented. Some of us are kind of laid back, and others are bent more towards confrontation. Some are leaders, some are followers. Some are great at caring for practical needs. Others excel at thinking about what needs to happen a year from now. Some are great at little tasks, and some of us that drives absolutely bonkers. The reason God brings us together as a church family is so that we can work together, complementing one another, in order to accomplish the task that God's given us. Practically, this is a reason why we're beginning slowly to organize ourselves in gospel communities, because that gives a consistent environment in which you can do that on a practical level. So to apply that to mission, for example, let's say you're reaching out to a sports team like Madison talked about last week. One person might be great at meeting and establishing a relationship. Somebody else might be the one that actually presents the gospel to that person. When we work together as a group, we can function within our strengths. That's a great thing. But all of us have a crucial, vital role that we need to play in order for the mission to be accomplished. So Jesus is the king who left to receive his kingdom. He now has it. And one day he'll physically return to reign fully here. This is what we've talked about many, many times throughout Luke, the balance of already and not yet. That's what Jesus is getting at in this story. This fact that in some sense, the kingdom has already come. There is the good of the king over anybody who has submitted their lives to them. So any of us that believe in the gospel and have put our faith in Jesus already have Jesus as our king, right? That's a wonderful thing. We don't have a mean, cruel, evil king. We have a good king, a kind king, a gracious king. But we're still caught in a world that's broken, hurting, and messed up. And so there's tension there between already we have the king and we don't have the kingdom fully yet. So Jesus told this story to teach us, how do we live in that gap between already and not yet? Jesus is calling us to live well in the gap, to make use of the fact that there's a delay, to honor him with what he's entrusted us to steward well. So the disciples, if we put this back in their context, they were on the cusp of the biggest disappointment of their lives. They were about to make the trek into Jerusalem, and if you know the story, what were they expecting? They were expecting Jesus to be king. He was king. So, yes. But they were expecting a certain kind of king. They were expecting a king who would go into Jerusalem, who would rally the troops, and who would overthrow Rome and establish a kingdom that would never end. And this would be the greatest days that Israel had ever had. They thought they were on the front edge of something that was about to happen right then. They thought the tyranny of Rome was about to be overthrown and the full presence of God was about to rest on his people. They thought Jesus was going to sit on an earthly throne and be the king forever. So instead, just a few days after Jesus told this story, he would die a criminal's death. That would be a bit of a downer, right? If you're expecting your king to reign forever and your king dies on you, that would be disappointing and confusing, to say the least. Jesus told this story to prepare them for what they were about to face. But what about us? Well, maybe you're here today and you're disappointed with Jesus. Maybe he hasn't done what you thought he was going to do. Maybe he hasn't delivered in the way you expected. Maybe you thought, if I do this for God, then he's going to do this for me. Maybe you didn't put it that way, but deep down in your heart, that's what your expectation was. But my dear friend, like the disciples, the problem here isn't God. The problem is our misconceptions of what God has promised us. In this already not yet, in this living in the gap, we're not promised easy lives, regardless of how morally upright you live. We're not promised that we won't get diseases and spouses won't leave. Children won't die. We won't lose jobs. God has not said any of those things won't happen. What he's promised is his love, eternal protection, so we can't lose our salvation, and one day he'll return. And in the meantime, he's promised us that he would empower us for mission. So we've been entrusted with all the resources that we need to accomplish the task of making disciples. Gifts, talents, strengths, personalities, time, money, energy, all of those things God's given to us in order that we would use them to grow ourselves, to grow each other, and to make more disciples. And to pull this out of a pretend story and pull it into the real world, Jesus will return one day to see how we've done at our mission. And when he does that, he's going to find that there's three responses. And he will react in three ways. So King Jesus will react to what we've done in three different ways. Some of us, like the folks in the story, will receive rewards. Those of us here who have faith in Jesus and who have been faithful with what God has given us, we'll find that we're given reward. Now, don't miss that. Isn't that amazing? The perfect God of the universe is going to say, well done. He's going to say, I'm proud of how you've handled the life I've given you. And then he's going to entrust us with serving alongside him in his kingdom. That's amazing. Biblically speaking, responsibility in God's kingdom is reward from him. It's a gift to be used by God. Now, I think honestly that we really revolt against that idea, especially as Americans. The lie we're told is spend your life working all you can, saving all you can, so you can devote the last chunk of your life to yourself. That's the American dream. And along the way, if we can accumulate lots of stuff and see lots of movies, play lots of video games, have lots of hobbies, wear the best clothes, drive the nicest cars, then we've made it. And sadly, churches seem to give that kind of message as well. And if this means that we've got to shirk every other responsibility that God's given us, then so be it. That is the American dream, right? If we put it crassly. We don't like to take responsibility for the good of others. This is why so few fathers are present for their kids. Why so few husbands really tend and care for their wives. Why young people today rampantly reject the idea of marriage. It's why porn is a multi-billion dollar business. It's why no matter how much we make, it's never enough. It's why we're reluctant to take responsibility to talk to each other about difficult things in our lives. We simply don't want to take responsibility. But the God of the universe wants to work through you. That's why you're here. He wants to take his power and flow it through you and give you the blessing of being used by God. That's where you get life and joy and fulfillment. It's not through all that other garbage. And experientially, we know that, friends. So this first group, those that don't fall prey to that kind of life, will be rewarded by God. That'll be awesome. Others, so that third servant, others of us will be rejected by Jesus. The third servant in the story made excuses for not doing anything. He blamed his inaction on the king. But really those actions showed that he didn't love the king. That he loved his time, his resources, his money, his gifts more than the king. He was indifferent. He really didn't even know the king. Now, what's odd about the story is he hung around. He stayed in, quote, in the kingdom, if you will. And by outward appearance, it looked like he was one of everybody else, right? But what does Jesus say to him? Well, he called him evil. He took what was entrusted to him, and he gave it to somebody else. Now, what does that mean? What's the correspondence there to real life? Well, please hear me closely in this. What saves us, what makes us right with God, is not our works. It's not what we do. What saves us is belief in Jesus. However, good works, following through on the mission that God's given us, being changed by God to look more Christ-like, these things provide indisputable evidence regarding the presence or absence of salvation. So, yes, we're not saved by what we do, but we show whether or not we're saved by what we do. That is simply a dominant theme in the Bible that we often miss. So some will appear all along like they were part of us, but they never showed it by how they lived. And by not showing it, they will show they weren't really part. That's Jesus' point. It seems a bit harsh, but actually it's a loving warning, isn't it? Because he's saying, I don't want this to happen to you. I don't want you to be someone that gets to the end and think you made it, think you were part, and you weren't. So examine your heart today, friend, if you consider yourself a follower of Jesus. Why? Is there any evidence of that in your life? The final group that Jesus will encounter is what we read about in the last verse. These were people who rejected him outright, from beginning to end. These are folks who say things like, "We don't want you as our king. Religion is for the weak. I'm just fine on my own. What's right for you isn't right for me. There's no God. The Bible was just written by foolish men. God is a figment of your imagination." To these, Jesus will give what they've asked for. They've asked for an eternity apart from him. They've persisted in stubborn refusal to bend their knee to God. And so they'll spend eternity apart from him. So, if you walk away with one thing today, I hope it's this. If Jesus returned today, and he could, right? If the already not yet ended an hour from now, and Jesus was to line all of us up and say, "What have you done with what I've entrusted to you?" Which person would you be? Only you can answer that before God. Would you be the one rewarded by God for faith in Jesus Christ, trust in the gospel, and faithfulness in mission? Or would you be one condemned because you pretended to know God, but you never really did? Or would you be one that had always refused to follow God? That might not feel like a weighty, important, powerful question. But that's the most important question you can ever answer. Because that determines everything. So which would you be? The message of this whole middle section of Luke that we've spent so much time on is that neutrality with Jesus doesn't exist. You fall somewhere. Is it fully in God's camp? Imperfectly, but yes, striving to obey him? Is it pretending? Or is it outright rejection? Those are the only options you have. And Jesus, in this very last piece, before he marches in to complete his mission, is asking us, "What are you doing with me? What are you doing with what I've entrusted to you?" I hope that you're prepared to answer that today.